Welcome to San Diego Magazine's Happy Half Hour. This week, we're going to be, diving into some topics that we've never really kind of dove into. And, you know, sometimes we know we're talking about donuts, which we know Troy is obsessed with currently. And we talk about restaurants, openings and closings. And then, you know, one of the biggest topics to come around in a long time in San Diego is all of the sexual harassment cases and racism that is going through the San Diego craft beer scene. We're really honored a little bit later in the show, Beth Demon, a very well-known San Diego beer writer, national craft beer writer, and one of our beer writers. She's going to be joining us to really kind of take a dive into what's going on locally with the harassment and what's happening to fix these kind of problems. So we're super excited to have her.
Yeah, this is, if you guys haven't been following at all, you need to log on and look up on Instagram, Rat Magnet is the handle for Brianne, who's a craft beer brewer. And she has been a conduit for anonymous and safe complaints throughout the industry of harassment. It has been harrowing. And harrowing to listen to all of these accounts, thousands and thousands of accounts that have come out. It is, this is a moment in craft beer, you know, history, or, you know, that they really have an opportunity to make massive cultural shifts, you know, for a more, you know, egalitarian and, you know, harassment-free workplace. I mean, this is another, you know, seismic shift towards equality in the United States, especially in a specific industry that's specific to food. So I cannot wait to hear Beth's perspective because she's been covering this for a long time.
So let's just jump right into news. The Skydeck Food Hall is opening in Del Mar.
It's been in the works for a while, and it's opening on June 11th. It's on the second floor of the Del Mar Highlands Town Center, and the new food hall has 13 different restaurants and food concepts. So there's going to be a brewer's deck, a central cocktail bar, and according to Eater, some of the restaurants are Ambrosio 15, Zizikas Greek Street Food, and Marufuku Ramen from San Francisco. There's also going to be wine, coffee, and a sushi restaurant coming soon. Each restaurant is going to have its own seating area, so there's not going to be one big communal dining space the way that a mall food court does. And this part I appreciated. The developer, Pat Donahue, said they deliberately did not bring on any national chains or fast food brands for the food hall. So it's mainly local businesses as well as small businesses.
Yeah, I like that for the heart of it and for the business strategy, to be quite honest with you, on the developer side. I think that, you know, national chains, I have nothing against national chains. I love some national chains. True Food is one of my favorite places to go if I have time. I will actually go to the mall to get True Foods because I love their philosophy and everything else. But, you know, I think it makes more sense to pull in local standouts. You know, I mean, I would rather go to a place that had local places. You know, I'd rather go, I love Petco Park now because they have local vendors. You know, when it was just, you know, national, you know, Hebrew National and everything else, and nothing against Hebrew National, I love that dang hot dog, but I love even more that they've got Cardiff Nachos there, you know, and they've got Hodads and everything else. So I think this is a really great call for Del Mar.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here.
Uh-oh, here it is.
And there's a positive spin on this though. But so what if they did have a national chain in there that, because they have so much more capital behind them, they could potentially charge them more money to be a part of the space and reduce the cost for the locals?
Or like a big anchor tenant, you mean? Like a Shake Shack?
Yeah, something along those lines.
I think that's how most malls work, right? They get what they call the anchor tenant, like Marie said. You know, you get a Best Buy. You get a, you know, Ralph's. You get a Whole Foods. You know, something, you know, that are a Panera Bread that, you know, is never going to go out, you know, and a lot of times they will pay a premium on their spaces, and it does cut the rent a little bit, but I don't think you can cut it that much. You know, I mean, in spaces like that, I mean, I don't know if any chain that's going to be like, you know what, David, I love your chilaquiles. I'm going to pay double rent so you can start your business, man. You know, I mean, I would love to think that chains are like that, but I don't know. I love the idea. Dave, get it going.
I'll do my best. And speaking of fast food, the podcast favorite topic, Marie, there's some rumor of a hot chicken place coming to town. I'm just shocked. I'm flabbergasted that we're getting more chicken.
And yes, I put an apology in the notes that we can all see, but that the listener can't. But like I said, we are just talking about what's happening, and this is in the headlines. So Jay Birds from Long Beach is going to expand to Carlsbad. So they are a Nashville hot chicken company that they fry the chicken in a tempura batter, and you can also top the sandwich with mac and cheese. They have 6 heat levels, and the hottest is called the Reaper. So they're in Long Beach, Orange County, and recently opened in Sherman Oaks. And this will be their first San Diego expansion. But dear listener, after this, I promise to stop reporting on the chicken for a while.
Never,
unless Howling Rays says that they're going to open a second location, then okay, fine. But all right, I'll ease up on the chicken.
Dude, never, Marie. There's something we love about you. It'd be like, you know, a sommelier showing up without any wine to my dinner party. Hey, you know what I mean? Chicken, fried chicken sandwiches are just part of your soul now. You know.
I don't think I've ever heard Marie have a chicken sandwich though for her two people $50.
I seriously, maybe she doesn't really like chicken sandwiches. They just pop up in her news feed and she's like, damn, chicken sandwiches.
Well, I don't really have the metabolism to eat them as much as I would like. So that is one reason why I haven't been naming them for my two people $50.
Hey, the chicken sandwich craze. I mean, look, God bless them. I love a good sandwich. I love good fried chicken. I mean, and the Nashville fried chicken took off, and you know, Popeyes got into it, and there was like, you know, riots over these chicken sandwiches. It's basically what's happening to chicken sandwiches, what happened to ice cream with Ben and Jerry's. You know, it's just like people are getting like more and more diverse of the same product, you know, and now the only thing that, like, where Ben and Jerry's could throw like, you know, pretzels and chocolate and like parts of radiators in there just to, you know, make it interesting, all they have to deal with is spice level. So they're like getting more and more spice levels. There's going to be one place that comes out, it's going to have like 300 different spice levels of your fried chicken. I know this is going to happen, and Marie's going to report on it first.
So we got another out of town expansion coming to town. We've got some food from Portland.
So it's a bagel shop and a Jewish deli, Ben and Esther's Vegetarian Jewish Deli. They announced that they're going to open in Rolando, in a strip mall over by where Chewy's taco shop is on El Cajon Boulevard. So they are known for their East Coast style boiled bagels, and they also have vegan and vegetarian versions of classic Jewish deli dishes. So they have something called a not lox. It's brined carrots instead of salmon. They have a vegan Reuben, and they also have a vegetarian matzo ball soup. So they did start as a regular deli, but during 2020, they completely transitioned their menu to all plant-based.
Nice. I love this. Anytime we get more bagels in San Diego, because my wife claims that we don't have any great bagels, we have not done an exhaustive search. So please, any good bagel makers out there in San Diego, please don't hate my wife. But that maybe that'll be the next one. Speaking of bagels, and I'm going to totally switch this news topic, but I went into Nomad Donuts this last week and happened to see Brad while I was in there picking up my donuts. Brad is the owner. We've had him on the podcast before. If you want a really great interview with him from last summer, well, during the middle of Black Lives Matter movement, check out that podcast. But he was in there. He's really obsessed with making the best bagels, and he'll be sitting there inside that picture window with his raw dough, and he'll just be slinging it on his finger, dropping it in the hot cauldron. It looks like Mickey's Fantasia pot, you know, and he'll just pull it out after 45 seconds, dip it in cornmeal, throw it in his oven with his big long paddle. But what he has is some that he's such a perfectionist that he won't sell these, because some of them over ferment a little bit and they turn fugly. They turn a little like, you know, funky and warped, and, you know, and he's like, dude, I won't sell these because they don't look great, but try them. He's like, the taste is amazing. Ask Brad for his ugly, unsellable bagels. They're the better bagel. It's like extra fermenty and tasty and bagely. It's just phenomenal. The guy's gonna hate me for like writing this, but go ahead and ask Brad for the ones he won't sell.
And one last thing, we want to let you know that our best restaurants voting has just started up.
So we just launched it on Tuesday, June 1st, and it's going to be going on until June 15th. And please vote for your favorite restaurants. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to note that we do listen to our readers, and from a reader's request, we did add some new categories. We're going to have Caribbean food and also Mediterranean. And this was actually really a good observation from our reader that we do have a lot of Jamaican restaurants, and we do have more restaurants that are from the Caribbean that are opening. We have a Puerto Rican deli. We have more Cuban restaurants. So we're excited to include that. Troy, did you want to talk about this year's program and just why it's important that our readers and listeners participate?
Yeah, I mean, we've done best of, you know, San Diego restaurants, you know, since, I don't know, since 1936 or something like that in San Diego Magazine, you know, and I always struggled this personally as a writer who loves restaurants and loves food culture and just likes telling the stories of the people and the history and the science and everything else behind specific foods. You know, I like to just kind of let the story tell itself. So I don't love, I've never loved, you know, picking a best of, you know, but I do it every year, you know, and especially now, because I really think that it's our chance to shine a light on 200 restaurants. You know, I mean, there are the readers' picks, there's my picks, you know, there is all told like 200 restaurants that kind of get a shine on them, you know, and I think that that's the most important thing. And, you know, is any list of best ever, quote unquote, right, or the just or the true or the light? No. You know, these are our favorite things. These are some of our, we've been eating out, you know, as much as we could over the last year, obviously, you know, and over the last couple of months, especially since I got vaccinated. But, you know, we've been eating out and just taking notes and just trying to share some of the best things that we've found with our readers. It isn't about like naming one over the other, even though it is to quote unquote, you know, it's more about what we can do to bring some light, especially coming out of the pandemic to the restaurants in San Diego, because they're getting on their feet, and this is kind of a celebration and an honor of them. That's really my my take on it, you know, because it's something that I've debated with ethically for a long time. Like, why do I mention best? There's like 9 best, and I'm like, you know what? People love this list, and if I had to actually make a list, you know, and like that I would send to my friends, I would be able to pick one. I would, you know. So this is it, you know. So this is us just saying, like, if I had to pick one, gun to my head, where would you go for French? This is it, and so. I love this issue, and we're going to have a big, big party with real people in a real space, in a very, you know, like a celebration of humanity. You know, now that the entire world has opened back up again, we're going to actually get together and have some of these restaurants there. And I'm so damn looking forward to it.
I cannot wait for that day as well. So that is Hot Plates for your week. Marie does put up a blog post on sandiegomagazine.com every week, giving more detail into these news topics. And we want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions, need any recommendations, any guests you want on the show, or do you want to sponsor this little podcast? We have a whole bunch of really cool sponsors coming up, by the way. Give us a call at 619-744-0535. Leave us a voicemail, or you can email us at happyhalfhour@sdmag.com. And remember that if you do love this podcast, and you want to support San Diego Magazine, please subscribe. You can figure out how to subscribe by going to sandiegomagazine.com as well. Joining us now, this week's special guest is Beth Demon, a freelance writer and journalist who specializes in craft beer. Beth moved to San Diego in 2008 and joined the craft beer scene as it began to take off. She started writing about craft beer in 2015 and has been an advocate for diversity in the industry. She founded the Diverse Beer Writers Initiative and is a member of the North American Guild of Beer Writers. Recently, she published an article on VinePair exposing rampant sexism and harassment that has been occurring in the beer industry, and it got national attention. The recent allegations were brought up to light by Brianne Allen, a brewer in Massachusetts. Beth is a regular contributor to San Diego Magazine and has also written for several other national media outlets.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest issues that's faced a food or drink industry in a long, long time. And Beth is going to give us some perspective on, you know, what, you know, went on after those articles and all those stories broke. Beth, thank you for coming on. So Beth, I can't imagine what the last 3 weeks has been for you, you know, as somebody who's fought for, equality, both in terms of gender, race, everything else, and especially in the craft beer industry, but in the food industry and drink industry overall. In the last 3 weeks, I mean, you've just covered one of the most explosive stories that the beer industry has seen. And I mean, for me at least, just being an outside observer, I haven't seen something like this happen to the beer industry in a long time and possibly overdue. How's it been on you emotionally?
Emotionally, I do feel like I was better equipped, or as equipped as I could possibly be, because like you said, I've been reporting on problems in craft beer for years and years and years, but it really has been the biggest reckoning we've seen so far. We've seen racial reckonings happen with things like the founder's racial discrimination lawsuit. We've seen other accusations of sexism and toxic workplace cultures at places like Boulevard, but this is really the first time that it kind of hit a national and global scale. And in San Diego, we certainly didn't remain unscathed from a lot of the allegations that have come out. So, I mean, emotionally, it was a little bit more difficult just knowing that I've interacted with or even were friends with some of the people who were named as well as victims and people who were affected. So intellectually processing it as a reporter was a challenge, but really emotionally processing it was a bit of a challenge as well. But I mean, things are still coming out. I mean, even just yesterday, and today it's continuing. So, I mean, it's challenging. It's difficult, but it's important.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine maybe you were a little bit more emotionally prepared because you have been in this, I mean, kind of looking at these stories for a long time and processing it more than, say, the general public has. I mean, me as as somebody who hasn't been so close to sexual harassment, you know, in the industry, reading some of those accounts on Rap Magnet's feed were just harrowing. I mean, it was terrifying and sad. And I mean, it was just, I mean, you get the chills at how big this issue is.
Well, exactly right. And I mean, some of the allegations really described very graphic instances of assault, rape, things like that. But then, I mean, it started just talking about the everyday microaggressions that lead to those types of really, you know, you said harrowing. I think that's the perfect word, those types of accounts. So, I mean, really even just things that people like to pass off as jokes or, you know, lighten up. This is why are you taking this so seriously? It's just beer. Those types of things and that type of dialogue really allows this type of bad behavior to proliferate. And I think people are just saying, we're not going to take it anymore.
So Beth, when you mentioned microaggressions, so the story that you did in VinePair, it mentioned Brienne's, you know, encounter when she went to the brewery and somebody asked for her credentials. And those are quote unquote microaggressions, you know, but when people hear micro, they may kind of belittle it and say, oh, come on, just, you know, don't do that. But it really is those things, those small acts of invalidating someone that kind of add up to a larger culture, right? Well, talk to us about why that's important.
Well, what's the phrase? It's something like, you know, death by 1,000 cuts. You still die, whether you get stabbed one time or 1,000 times in a row. And these microaggressions eventually, yes, individually, they might just be little pebbles of annoyance that you have to deal with day to day, but eventually it turns into a mountain. And it also provides a gateway to normalize bad behavior. So, you know, you make a joke and you get away with it, and then maybe you escalate to touching without consent or even assault or rape or some of these more serious toxic workplace cultures that are being totally allowed to flourish. And so it really does start with little things that always tend to escalate into larger things. And this isn't a beer problem. This is a society problem. But of course, alcohol is going to exacerbate the types of dangers or allow people to feel more empowered to do things that they know that they shouldn't. And so that, I think, is the slight difference when we're talking about these types of things happening in beer rather than just hospitality at large.
Right. And do you think that COVID-19 played a part in why, you know, people who have experienced harassment of any kind, sexual harassment, you know, racial harassment, whatever it may be, you know, do you think that COVID-19 kind of said, you know what, we're not going to put up with this anymore, because people were away from it for so long. They hadn't experienced it. They weren't so accustomed to those microaggressions and that kind of like, oh, you know what, this is just the culture. Do you think that COVID-19 really played a part in helping people stand up and say, okay, this isn't cool anymore. I'm coming back, but not like that.
Absolutely. Not only was it just people got used to not being treated like crap, people were at home and it gave them the time and space to start caring about things that they didn't previously. I mean, look at the protests and social justice movement that happened after the murder of George Floyd. I mean, that is, it's the same type of thing where people have the time, space, and energy to dedicate to caring about things that they didn't have to. And now there's no excuse not to.
Mm-hmm. And what about, what are some of the things that surprised you that came out of this? I mean, you're somebody, again, who's been, you know, studying this and reporting on this for a long time in the industry, and you've probably dove deeper than 99.9% of humanity into this issue. What surprised you?
I wouldn't say much surprised me. Mm-hmm. Other than the sheer volume of accounts, because it's one thing to kind of abstractly know how pervasive this is. It's another thing to be faced with names, faces, times, dates, corroborating accounts, people coming forward and saying, yes, that's true. I saw it happen. And I'm willing to put my name on that as well. And there were plenty of anonymous accounts because there is a lot of fear of retribution, whether it be industry blacklisting, legal threats, anything like that. And so I think now just the sheer number of accounts, but also the sheer number of corroborating accounts was a weirdly, like, I don't want to say pleasant surprise, but that was something new and valuable that I think happened in this particular instance.
Yeah. And people standing up, not only because it's one thing for somebody to finally stand up for something that's really like emotionally hurtful for them. You know, I think that sometimes, I mean, you have an impetus, you know, it's like, I need to get this off my chest. I need to make change. You know, this has hurt me personally, but for other people to actually stand up that weren't even just said, I saw it. It didn't happen to me personally, but I need to back this up. It felt like everybody needed to stand up for this. Now, what are some of the most heartening actions that you've seen come of this? Because we can all talk about this. And somebody in your article on Vine Pair said, my worry is that we talk about this and then we don't talk about it. You know, what specific actions have come about that you've seen over since the weeks that you, since you've been reporting on this?
I will say that I think for the first time, I'm seeing more men step up and say, we accept responsibility and understand that it is our responsibility to put a stop to this when we see it, because it's not just affecting the women around us. We are either actively or passively, but either way, perpetuating a toxic culture where it's causing people to leave the industry. It's causing people to, I mean, it's just, it's incalculable the losses that women and other marginalized people have had to incur just to make it, you know, to keep it a boys' club, to uphold the status quo. And so I think that some of the positive things that are coming out of it are, you know, men stepping up and saying, we're going to, you know, do our part to stop this from happening. But also organizations are, yes, they're making statements of solidarity, but I think that there are tangible things being put into place to prevent this from happening. You know, you're looking at implementing codes of conduct for beer festivals, for being a part of trade organizations like the Pink Boots Society or a local brewers guild, or really even the Brewers Association. We're looking at breweries starting to implement third-party reporting systems, whether or not they have an HR person in place already. And so I do think that there are things being taken seriously and put into effect that are going to help prevent it. Will it help completely eradicate sexism, racism, misogyny in craft beer? Absolutely not. That's a people problem. That's a humanity. That's a society problem. But I think that I'm cautiously optimistic that some of the things that organizations are putting into place will make a difference.
And what about, I've seen some people say that, you know, these small brewers, they don't have HR, you know, I mean, they don't have, you know, the human resources to deal with this, you know, and is that an excuse? Is it, you know, is it, you know,
well, it's an explanation. It's not an excuse.
Right. Right. I gotcha. Now, what is the solution? Now, I understand that you put forward the Brewers Association, which is, you know, a national association that kind of, you know, is an umbrella for all of the craft beer companies, you know, and you had suggested that they need to, you know, they need to step up a little bit more. There needs to be more systems in place to be able to report this. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, they've needed to step up in a number of ways for a really long time. And I think that history has shown that they are, I think one of the phrases I used in one of the pieces was their hands are tied by ropes of their own binding. Like they have made it so that they are not going to do it. I mean, they're not going to do anything. Like, we can't really expect the top down, you know, trickle down equity. Like, we've seen that in economics, it doesn't work. In equity, it's not going to work. It's really going to be up to the individuals and people feeling empowered and safe enough to say, hey, that wasn't right, or I didn't like the way that that sounded, or things like that. And so I think it, you know, unfortunately, the onus really is going to fall on the consumer, the employee, the individual to really make change from the bottom up than expecting it to be from the top down. But that doesn't mean that trade organizations should wash their hands of it. I mean, when we're talking about organizations of the magnitude of the Brewers Association, I understand the reality of them not being able to be an enforcement agency or really being able to police their member behavior, because their goal is to lobby on behalf of the industry and not necessarily be, you know, the police officer for the industry. Like, that would totally spread them too thin, and then they wouldn't be able to accomplish anything. I get that. But you also need to look at leadership and know that they're going to have your back. And whether or not they put together some sort of, like, I don't know, even if it's a toothless code of conduct or avenue for being able to dismiss members who go against a code of conduct, even if it's pathetic, it's better than nothing. And at the very least signals that they've got progressive values in the forefront, and they are wanting that to be a cornerstone of the industry. We've said it has been for a long time. It hasn't been. It's time to make that change.
Right. And the in terms of you personally, I've noticed, you know, I've been watching your Instagram account, you know, when you've been documenting, you know, helping Rat Magnet and Brienne. Sorry, I keep calling her Rat Magnet. That's her handle on Instagram.
It's a great name.
It's a great handle.
Yeah, it's so one good.
Of the best. But you know, you've been really amplifying that and doing obviously a ton of work on your own too, and, you know, also being a conduit. But it seems like you've also gotten, you know, hate. You've also gotten some aggression because of the reporting. I mean, can you, how big of a problem is that for you?
Honestly, I don't allow it to be a huge problem for me, because I've been doing this for such a long time that it's just kind of part of the deal. Like, I understand that people aren't going to appreciate being called a racist or a sexist or somebody who has committed sexual assault. Like, yeah, nobody wants to hear that. And if they want to lash out at me, then that's something that, if that makes them feel better and it makes it not hurt somebody else in a very tangible way, then fine. Like, whatever. I just, you know, I am a human being. Like, there is a limit to the amount of just crap that I can emotionally take, but it's pretty high. So, you know what? I do my due diligence in terms of just, like, protecting myself legally. You know, I make sure that I use the right terminology of allegations and things like that. But just in terms of, like, the day to day, I just file it away and don't spend any time worrying about what those types of crap people think about me, because their opinion is just not important to me.
Yeah, there's a couple crap people on the internet, I think. It's a small collection of a few billion people that like that.
Oh, do not dive into the depths of beer Twitter, because it is just, whew, man. Like, I take things seriously, but some people take things really seriously. So, good Lord.
So are there any local breweries that you think are really kind of going above and beyond when it comes to making it so, like, putting these practices in place so that, you know, we're not having these cases come up because we're making it that it won't exist to begin with?
Gosh, you know, I feel like there are some people who are making a difference, and it's difficult because I feel like I've been so focused on holding people accountable that it's easy for me to miss who's doing something right, because it's hard for me to applaud doing the bare minimum. You know, like, I'm like, great, you have a code of conduct, you have anti-harassment processes in place and things like that. Like, you know, like, good for you, but also, like, not really. So, I mean, I do think that there are a number of people, I even hesitate to name names of who I think is doing it right, because even like yesterday and today, somebody that I might have mentioned as an ally or a supporter of women in beer, was named. So it's like, you know, I don't know every single thing about every single person, and everybody's got their stuff. Everybody has said something that they didn't mean, or like a joke that just didn't quite land right. And it's hard to kind of gauge where that line falls individually, but also it's going to be different for everybody. So, I mean, I think that the Brewers Guild, I'm on the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee. We're starting to put together a code of conduct that will allow us to expel members who break that code of conduct or who are very obviously doing things that they shouldn't be and we've decided are not going to be tolerated as a guild member. We are putting together a code of conduct task force to rewrite the bylaws, really. And so there are a number of you know, I would say women-owned or minority-owned breweries that I think are going to inherently do a better job of stopping this before it starts just by virtue of the leadership and the culture that they've created for themselves. You know, places like Border X, Mujeres Brew House, Chula Vista Brewery, the Second Chance Brewery. I think that the places that have these types of things already built into their culture, rather than being reactive, are going to inherently just do a better job. And so we should be looking to those types of places for guidance.
And to reiterate, you know, and as part of this, you know, Brienne's account, Rat Magnet, acted as a conduit for, you know, and it was an anonymous, a safe conduit for people, anybody, men, women, whoever, to experience harassment, you know, to just talk about the experiences that they had. You know, some people have said, well, what about the verifications of those claims? I mean, how, you know, are you triple verifying them? Is it legally okay, you know, to do this? You know, I mean, how do you stand on that? I mean, how do you balance that by providing an anonymous, safe, real force for change in these firsthand accounts, while also making sure that some people don't erroneously get caught under the bus, I guess. It seems to me a huge, I don't know how I would.
It's risky. It's risky. And she definitely took on an enormous amount of risk. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why this took off in the way that it did when, you know, previously it hadn't before. And so, like, I get approached all the time with people who have stories of something that happened to them, whether it be locally or nationally or something like that. And so many times I am not able to move that story forward, whether it just be lack of independent verification or any corroboration whatsoever, or it's only happened to one person. And unfortunately, that story is just not a story. I was treated badly at my job isn't going to be on the front page of any newspaper, mm-hmm. whether or not that is right. That's just right. Not. Yeah. And so when you look at the rate of false allegations made of, you know, sexual harassment or assault, it's most places, and I mean, these are you know, organizations like RAIN, which is the largest anti-sex violence organization in the entire country. They put the number of false claims at something between 2-10%, and most places have it closer to 2-3%. So are there going to be occasions where somebody is falsely accused? Yes. Is it so unlikely and rare that we should discount every single thing that comes out of fear of that? No. And I think when you look at the things that Brienne posted and the independent verification that happened for so many of them, mm-hmm. even if 2% of them were false, that is still thousands of accounts mm-hmm. that are true. So yes, I'm less worried about somebody being erroneously thrown under the bus because the likelihood of that is so low. And honestly, I think that the truth always does come out. If that's anything that we've learned from this, is that there is going to be a boiling point where the cognitive dissonance of existing in this space of like, oh, we're such a inclusive, equitable community, when like that's just not the reality. Mm-hmm. I think that it's always going to come to light. And so if you truly are falsely accused, you know, come forward and say your side of things. But I think that that's extremely, extremely rare and very, very, very unlikely.
the greater good. And to continue on that point of 2 to 10%, I mean, and that's a very small number of, you know, false claims. I mean, that's historically measured, you know, but also a majority of cases aren't even reported, right?
Oh, I think it's something like 63% of cases aren't even reported. So it's, I mean, I worry much less about the, you know, microscopic fraction of a percent versus the, you know, 99.9% of things that are absolutely true. And if you're just looking at this, you're not even looking at independent or at the individual accounts, you're just looking at what's happening at large. That's the story. That's what you need to focus on and say, I don't need to know every single individual bad actor in the craft beer industry, because we've lost count now. Like, there's just too many. So just looking at it at large is saying, like, wow. If you aren't looking at this and saying, wow, something needs to change, I don't know what you're looking at, because obviously that's right. What needs to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And in San Diego, do you think that San Diego, every city has its own kind of self-monitoring and microculture within a bigger culture, right? You know, do you think that San Diego as a whole is doing well? Is taking actionable measures, is really taking this seriously? Or do you think, like, we got to catch up with some of the bigger cities, or where are we at?
I think that people look to San Diego as a leader in craft beer, not only for the quality of beer that's coming out of us, but also just the number of breweries. I mean, we have more breweries than like any other place in the entire country. So yes, we're going to have more problematic people on an industry, but if you look at it as kind of like a per capita rate, I don't necessarily think that we're any better or worse, quote unquote, culturally than any other place. I think one of our downfalls is just kind of that San Diego attitude. We don't like confrontation. We like everybody to kumbaya, get along, drum circles in Ocean Beach, smoke weed. Like, great. We love it. I love chilling with people, and I would love to just chill with people, but until people in beer stop grabbing butts when they're not supposed to and honking boobs when they're not supposed to and making these just crap comments, then we can't just chill and get along. So we have to change.
There are basic ground rules if you want to attend the drum circle in Ocean Beach. Yeah.
Right. Just be cool. Just don't assault people. It's like really baseline stuff.
And do you think, last question for me, and then anybody else who wants to add it, please, and I'm sorry if I'm hogging, but do you think that this is a loud noise that goes away? Do you think this is really going to have, is it going to take 7 bangs like this, like 7 big, loud, eruptive events that just draw light on this? Or do you think this is it? Like, this is going to enact real long change, that the conversation is now going to continue and not just fade?
I think both things will happen. I think that there will be big sweeping changes that change the face of craft beer, both here and outside of San Diego. I also think that there are going to be a number of people who just refuse to accept accountability. I mean, there are people who are voluntarily stepping down from their positions, whether it be as brewers, as owners, as employees, whatever. They are stepping away from their breweries. I don't know if it's, you know, financially divested or not, but at the very least, they're taking a step back and they're accepting some level of responsibility for the culture that they have perpetuated. There are also a number of people who just absolutely do not give a crap, are just going to keep doing what they do, and they'll probably get away with it. People will probably not care in a year if they have not actively taken steps to repair the damage that they've caused towards other people. So yeah, there's going to be people who get away with it, and that sucks. And there's going to be people who don't get away with it, and that's great. But I think it's going to be a little bit of both. But I do think that this is going to be a turning point, and we're never going to go back to the way that it was.
Awesome.
That's great. Beth, I know that you're super tight on time. Can you let everyone know where they can find you on social media and places to find you so that they can continue to learn more?
Sure. My Instagram is at The Delighted Bite. Twitter is just at Delighted Bite. And I do recommend, if you have absolutely no idea what we are talking about or what's going on, Brienne on Instagram, her at Rat Magnet, she has kind of passed the torch to a new handle called at Embolden Act Advance, all one word, no spaces or underscores or anything. Embolden Act Advance. And so if you want to keep up with the allegations that are continuously rolling in, be sure to check that out as well.
And we will make sure to link to that in any blog post that we put up on the website too, because it is a great resource for continuing the conversation for change. Let's jump into Two People, 50 Bucks, if you guys are all right with that.
Yeah, let's do it.
Beth, where are you going?
So if I'm getting takeout, I'm 99.9% of the time going to Ang Korean Pike Staff in downtown San Diego. It's only like once every other week or so, but her just like Asian fusion, Cambodian inspired dishes every single time is a total slam dunk, home run, whatever sports thing you want to say. That's where I'm going. That's where I recommend.
Have not been there.
What?
I have not. I know. And I'm downtown all the time. Maybe that'll be my lunch spot today.
David's been hiding in Vermont for a long time. Mm. We just got him back. So we have to Yeah, we had to kind of give him like the reprimer of his own home city, you know.
Welcome now home. Welcome Thank home. You. Go to Pike Staff. Bottom line.
Consider it done.
All right. So Two People, 50 bucks. I'm on my spiritual quest to find the best donuts. And I've obviously we in San Diego, and obviously we use these to kind of tell the stories of the people behind it. And one of the stories that I came across is Broad Street Donuts in Encinitas. And Broad Street is a local girl. She was, you know, born and raised here in San Diego, loved VG's Donuts, and, you know, the pandemic hit and she had talked about opening up a place that was a little bit different because they do donuts made to order. And her and her fiance opened up this place. It's in the Lumberyard, which is, you know, a little, you know, kind of like shopping center in Encinitas that if you don't know to look for something, you might miss it. You should definitely check out Broad Street Donuts. Oh, holy crap. They do them to order. So they're hot. They come right out of the fryer. They do the icing right there. They've got these little cronut bites with sugar and cinnamon on them. And they're just warm and delicious. Their blueberry glazed donut is phenomenal. And, you know, and it's a young husband and or fiancés, two fiancés. I was going to say husband and wife. That doesn't work. I was going to say whatever. Two fiancés who are local kind of giving their dream a shot because they had, you know, they had to make a change in the pandemic. Broad Street Donuts, made to order, hot and fresh. Fantastic.
Your hunt for the best donuts in town. I pray for your next blood work that you do not have diabetes.
can I admit something here? And this is something that we've done on, you know, just, I mean, in this profession, it's just like beer drinkers or beer tasters, like, you know, Beth yourself, I'm sure you've done this as well. I'm now spitting out donuts. And I mean, no offense, they're delicious. They're everything else, but I just can't do this and actually live. So I'm taking bites and really taking notes. And then I have a napkin next to me. That's it.
Yep. I'm in my late 30s. I can't be drinking 12 beers in a row. Like, it's just not happening.
I wanted pasta that I didn't boil myself and that did not come out of a box. So my friends and I went to Bencotto in Little Italy. And if you haven't been, they have a Parmesan wheel. So it's that big wheel of Parmesan cheese from Italy. I heard that those cost $1,500 a piece. And what they do is they put the cooked pasta into the Parmesan wheel and kind of mix it in with the cheese. They don't do it table side anymore, but they have a station right by kind of the hostess stand where you can go watch your pasta being made. So if whatever is the Parmesan wheel pasta of the week, just get it and share it with the table. And they also have a squid ink gnocchi that is fantastic and great cocktails. Bencotto for just really, really good handmade, homemade pasta.
Yeah, Bencotto, I mean, for me, was a gold standard. It still is the gold standard of pasta. And, you know, it's funny because there's been more like authentic, like house-made pastas, you know, that have come out too, just to give them a little bit of like, you know, that make the scene a little bit better. But, you know, I just went back there a couple weeks ago too. And Claire and I both went and she was like, Jesus Christ, this is the best pasta I've had. That wheel that you talk about, Marie. Oh, when they put it in there and it creates that little divot in the cheese. And the cheese just gets incorporated. Yeah. You start seeing it like string. Mm-hmm. Oh, fast.
Yeah, it's worth it, even though I have, lactose problems, TMI, you know, I've talked about it before. And I'm like, okay, I'm taking a whole box of pills because it is worth it. It's worth the risk.
Amazing.
Noah, on your second to last week with us here, what are you doing for two people, $50?
Man, it went by so fast. So this week I'm choosing Point Loma Fish Shop. It's right off Rosecrans. I had oysters for the first time there, and they were awesome.
Was that your first oyster ever?
My first oyster ever. I went on a fishing boat, and I picked Thursday because I was like, oh, I have nothing going on. So I go there. Thursday night happens to be their oyster night, where it's $1.25 an oyster. So it was actually really affordable. It was awesome.
Oh, it was meant to be.
It was, yeah.
All right. Now, remind me of what eating your first oyster is like, because it's only been 355 years since I did it. I still remember looking at that sea booger and just going, oh,
sea booger. No,
I don't know if I can do it. I know. I mean, come on, though. I mean, I love oysters, and they're beautiful and they're briny and they all have different flavors, but depending on where they're farmed or where they're wild caught. But you look down at it and you're like, God, that looks just biological. You know, it's like, how was it, buddy? How'd you do?
So here's the funny part. Like, I almost didn't make it past the counter because the lady there was so convinced I shouldn't get oysters. I was like, really? Oh, can I get six oysters? And she's like, are you sure? And I'm like, well, yeah.
Did she say why? Because it's summertime? Well, that's really a mess.
I said it was my first time. And she's like, oh, are you sure? Because like some people find it challenging. I'm like, no, I'll be okay. And she's like, oh, okay. Like, do you want anything else with it just in case? And I'm like, sure. Let's get the fish and chips too. Just in case. But I love the oysters. I don't know. I didn't think the texture was all that bad. They had me get more of like the chewier ones. So it wasn't like as slimy as I've heard, but I was a fan. I would do it again.
Nice.
Yay. Oh. I am so proud.
I know. It reminds me of the first time I went into one of my favorite Thai places, Saab E Lee, and they said, you know, I'll take a Thai hot, you know, and they're like, no, sure. Are you sure, white kid? You sure you really want to get this? Are you sure you want to do this to yourself? And I'm like, I'm a food writer. I can do this. So they gave it to me, absolutely blew my head off, and I immediately regretted it. They were so right. But I mean, I'm glad that they did not talk you into not getting oysters, Noah.
Yeah.
I went to one of my favorite patios for the first time since coming back, and I went to Kairoa Brewing right up off Park. Their beer has definitely got a lot better since they opened, which is a nice change for them. But really, their food is like out of this world good. And so I got the salmon sashimi, which is just like completely beautifully laid out. And it's covered then also with some avocado, some chili oil, some ponzu. And they give it a little bit of this crunchy quinoa over the top just to give it a little bit more texture, then some lime and then some radishes. Oh my gosh, it's just so delightful. And for like what you get for the price of it, it's really pretty great. Like, it was a really nice size portion, and I think it was like $14.
Awesome. 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 Noah, this is your second to last week with us. Next week, our fearless leader, Marie, is going to be off the podcast because she's going to be traveling, doing something, some highly important investigative work, or on vacation, which is like 7 years overdue. I'm not sure which, but I think she's going to let you read the news. Noah is going to read the news next week. Are you ready, buddy?
I'm so stoked. That's awesome.
Right on. With oysters nearby.
This is your pass or fail right here.
Yeah, right? My final, probably, hopefully my easiest final.
Definitely. Well, that was this week's Happy Half Hour. Once again, Beth had a little bit early, so we have to thank her so much for her insight. We love her to death here at the magazine. You can find me on Instagram at David Eli Martin. You can find Troy at Hey Troy Johnson, and you can email Marie at marieT@sdmag.com. And we'll be back next week.
See you guys.